You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment, with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. With four daughters and two on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house. But I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you got to get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, you're going to love it. Welcome back to another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. Hope that you had a great weekend. I watched a great documentary. I'm telling you guys, you're going to watch it and talk about it for days. It's called Some Kind of Heaven. So filmmaker Lance Oppenheim cracks the manicured facade of The Villages, which is this massive, self-contained retirement community located in Central Florida. So behind the gates of this utopia lies a small group of villages residents and one interloper who are unable to find happiness within the community's pre-packaged paradise. So the film opens and you're like, this is a college campus for retired people. And then they crack the door open and you learn about each person and it becomes more and more fascinating. It is so good. It reminds me of this retirement community that my husband's great auntie Thelma lived in called Leisure World. It's in Seal Beach, California. And we would go visit her and I swear you could not get her to leave. She was so into that community. They had so many events going on. She had a bunch of friends. She had so many great stories about the people who live next door to her and who she'd be seeing later. So I imagine that if you have a loved one that's in a retirement community, you will get an even bigger kick out of it. It also just makes me realize that there are not enough stories on television about that age group. So I thought it was great. It also reminded me of this book that I've loved for so long. It's on my list of my most favorite books. I'm telling you, you got to read it too. It's called Early Bird, A Memoir of Premature Retirement. So the author is Rodney Rothman. And when he was 28 years old, he was a comedy writer on late night TV. When he was 28, he went to live in a retirement community in Florida. And it is absolutely hilarious. Right after he wrote that book, my friend Meg invited me to go out with him for drinks. So we all went out. And it was one of the most fun nights I ever had in LA. And he's like a big time movie director now. So it's so odd. But that is a great book. It's a great gift to give as well. The other show I watched this weekend is called Empire Bling on Netflix. I'm almost through with all the episodes and it's unlike anything I've ever seen. It's a group of friends in LA and they're all Asian and they have more money than I could even begin to tell you. I'm talking like Dorothy Wang money. Like their parents are multi-millionaires. One of the women that's in the cast is the heir to some arms fortune. She's half Russian and she's half Chinese. And she just has like Gucci show up to her house with just racks of clothing and shoes. It's unbelievable. So that's something to watch too. And I think you'll notice some of the faces. I feel like they are friends with people that are also on reality shows. So they may have popped up on other people's Instagram feeds. You'll know what I mean. Like you're going to start to recognize some of them. And I think I'm going to be interviewing some of the cast too. So check that out. Empire Bling on Netflix. This is one of my most favorite episodes because I got a chance to talk to Tiger Woods' biographer. Tiger on HBO, which he also executive produced, is the two-part documentary offering a revealing look at the rise, fall, and epic comeback of global icon Tiger Woods. And this series paints an intimate picture of the prodigy whose dedication and obsession with the game of golf not only took his fame and success to new heights, but also down a dark spiraling road that eventually led to a legendary sports comeback, culminating in his victory at the 2019 Masters. So Tiger highlights never-before-seen footage and interviews with those who know Tiger Woods best, including his former caddy and close friend Steve Williams, golf legend Sir Nick Faldo, and his father Earl Woods' friend and biographer Pete McDaniel, his first true love, Dina, and Rachel Yucatel, the woman at the center of the sex scandal that forever altered Tiger's world and breaking her silence for the first time. So those two episodes have since aired. And Armin, who is the author of Tiger Woods, which is a best-selling book, is also executive producer of the Tiger HBO documentary, and he is my guest today. So Golf Digest has said his book is the number one New York Times bestseller based on years of reporting and interviews with more than 250 people from every corner of Tiger Woods' life. And this comprehensive, propulsive, and unsparing biography is an ambitious 360-degree portrait of golf's most scrutinized figure, brimming with revealing details. This conversation could have gone for hours, and I would have just been so happy. He is such a great storyteller and has done such a superb job telling his story. And I'm so excited to have you hear my conversation with Armin. So here we go. Armin Katayan is a journalist, an 11-time Emmy Award winner, co-author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Tiger Woods, executive producer of Tiger, which, as you know, is a two-part HBO documentary offering a revealing look at the rise, fall, and epic comeback of the global icon, Tiger Woods. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Kate.
I'm so excited to have you. I have read your book. I've listened to interviews you've done. I can't even imagine what this feels like to have this project finalized. If you know the final outcome, are you just thrilled with how it's all come out?
I am thrilled. I'm really proud of what the directors, starting with, you know, Alex Gibney, as you well know, is an Oscar-winning director of docs and Jigsaw Productions, and then Alex brought in just this kind of all-star team of talent, everybody from the two directors, Matt Heineman, who had directed Cartel, and Matt Hamacek, who was the principal editor, Emmy nominated. Heineman won an Emmy for Cartel, and Hamacek was nominated for an Emmy for his editing of the Amanda Knox documentary. So those two, coupled with everybody from Jenna Millman, a producer, to Trevor Davidowski, to just a kind of an all-star team of talent, as I said. So to see it finally, you know, last Sunday night on HBO, I had seen the final cut, and I was astonished by what they did in both parts. But, you know, I was really proud. The book is described as inspired by the documentary, was inspired by our book and based on our book. And so to have something that Jeff and I, my writing partner, Jeff Benedict, were so proud of, to collaborate with the likes of Alex Gibney and his team was just, I got to say, it's kind of a highlight of my career.
Absolutely. How long has it been now that you've been following Tiger?
Well, Jeff and I, to go back to the beginning, we had worked on a book called The System, which was this very deep dive into college football that took us a couple of years to report and write. And that came out in the fall of 13. And I was frankly kind of burned out because it was an enormous project and it took a lot of oxygen to get it done. And then at the end of 15, our agent Richard Pine came to us and said, you know, what do you guys think about doing about a book about Tiger Woods? And we're like, Tiger Woods, hasn't there been like a billion books written about him? But we started to do our research, and what we discovered, Kate, was that yes, there had been at least a dozen different books written about Tiger, either by his father or by Tiger, journalists covering Tiger, even Tiger himself. But there had never been this 360-degree immersive, comprehensive biography that Jeff and I were very interested in trying to do. So, you know, a little bit of a funny story. The proposal for The System, our college football book, was 60 pages long. The proposal for Tiger Woods was 4 pages long.
And oh, wow.
Simon and Schuster, yeah, it was interesting because basically, you know, on our reputations as reporters and writers, and the fact, I think at that time, Jeff and I, between the two of us, had done north of 20 different nonfiction books. It was snapped up pretty quickly by Simon and Schuster. And then, you know, we went to work, and it took us 3 years in the research. I think between the two of us, we read some 20 different books, certainly everything that had been written about Tiger, but also, you know, books about sex addiction and books about gifted children and books about Navy SEALs and all sorts of different things that would give us the basis and the foundation to understand certain aspects of Tiger's life. And then, I mean, I personally went through, I think, the transcripts of 350 press conferences that he had done beginning back into his amateur days and going forward. And so when you start to amass all this information, it does a couple of things. It allows you to, find people that had not talked before, whose lives had intersected with Tiger's, sometimes for only a brief period of time. But when you talked to them, you found that, it had a profound impact, sometimes both positive and negative, on their lives. So, that was really the book came out in, the hardcover came out in, April of 18. So, you know, you're talking about, you know, full-time job, even though at the same time I was, you know, the lead correspondent for 60 Minutes Sports and contributing to 60 Minutes. So, you know, really working two jobs. And finally, you know, the thing is funny is Jeff and I, Simon and Schuster, you know, they paid us handsomely to do it, but in the end, we just laughed. We worked for minimum wage because, I mean, the hours that we put in, I think it was thousands of hours. Between the reporting and the writing and the fact checking and the index and the source notes and everything else, and the interviews. But it's, as I said, it's really rewarding to see something that has stood the test of time. The reviews were really almost unimaginably good. And now to have the doc out, and there's actually a scripted series in the works that's been announced. I think we're one revision away from seeing the final script for a pilot, that will be, I'm guessing, somewhere between 6 and 8 episodes, a scripted series. And, so it's, you know, it's a gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah.
Thank goodness.
Well, that's what I love about your book, is that it is really a thorough examination of Tiger, and the fact that you did so much research into sexual addiction, into what it means to be a Green Beret. All of those things really kind of help us shape who he is, because he's a fiercely private person. And it's almost like he's encircled himself with privacy enablers. So to crack him open would seem almost impossible. So I first off, to congratulate you on a superb job. The first question is about, you know, he's this golf phenom as a child. What made him a great player, even as a child? Was it superior hand-eye coordination? What made him stand out amongst a sea of children that probably went to the golf course with their father or their mother?
That's a good question. I think it's there's multiple parts to that answer. One is, you have to understand the father-son dynamic and the relationship. And that, you know, part one of the doc, as you've seen, is really that is the foundation of that part one. Earl Woods and Tiger Woods. And what Earl gave to Tiger was a love of the game, an understanding of how to play golf, how to see golf, how to shape shots, how to act on the golf course, the importance of practice. But Earl was not a helicopter parent. There were times when they would practice together at the Navy course in Southern California in Orange County, which was really the training ground for Tiger, where Earl would be at one end of the range and Tiger would be at the other end. And the assistant pro, Joe Grohman, who was in part one, would come up to Earl and go, you know, why are you on this end and Tiger's on the other end? And Earl would say, well, if Tiger needs something from me, he knows where to find me. And so that dynamic, I think, was really important. So the passion that Tiger had for golf, I think, is directly associated with his dad and his love of practice, which is, I think, very different than younger kids growing up. Yes, they practice, but I know stories where Tiger would practice putting for 7 or 8 hours at a time, only taking a break to get something to eat or go to the bathroom. Mm. So that's one side of it. The other side is, and you cannot diminish it, is his mother, Catilda or Tita. She brought a very different dynamic to the equation, and that was the killer instinct. Earl was a softy in terms of emotions. Tita was the polar opposite. She was the one that would say to Tiger, you don't just beat them. You beat them in a way they never forget. You put your foot on their neck and you take their heart. I mean, this is a young boy who's 7 or 8 years old, right, driving to practice or driving to tournaments with his mother, you know, getting the lessons that have stayed with Tiger and certainly were at the heart of his greatness. He was just there's a lot of argument going on, especially now with the doc, about, oh my God, he had no choice. He was forced into this. And yes, there is a lot of that. Earl never really allowed Tiger to do anything but play golf. He never was on a team his entire life. Even though he liked to say sometimes he was on a team, he never was. So, you know, Kate, there's the driving force of both, I think, the book and the doc were really two questions. You know, who is Tiger Woods and what's the price of genius?
Absolutely.
You're beginning to see who is Tiger Woods, and you see how he's shaped by his parents. The price of genius is yet to come. And to me, that was always the most profound and interesting question is what is the price of extreme fame and fortune to be a child prodigy beyond almost anybody's expectations? And so that's what makes it so rich. You were right on. He's a very complicated person, incredibly protective of his privacy, held together by inner circle of tight circle of you mentioned the word enablers, and I think you're absolutely right, friends, but more importantly, you know, have enabled Tiger to get away with so much of what he got away with.
Well, tell me about his ego. His father had been quoted as saying that he expected him to be like a Gandhi. I mean, that's an enormous amount of pressure. He's an only child. His parents have put so much emphasis on the way he plays, the way he conducts himself. How does that factor into his ego?
I mean, that's an interesting question, because Earl's ego, I think, was much larger than Tiger's. I think Tiger was always comfortable just performing on the golf course. He was most comfortable inside the ropes, not outside the ropes. Whereas Earl found, great satisfaction in pontificating about, you know, his son's impact on the human race and the chosen one, the words that he used with Gary Smith, who wrote, I think, the definitive portrait early on for Sports Illustrated about Tiger. And the title of that magazine piece was The Chosen One. And you see that in the doc right in the beginning, when Earl is speaking at the National Collegiate Awards ceremony in a piece of footage that has never been seen before. So I think Tiger, honestly, his ego was pretty limited. I mean, he was a nerd growing up,
right?
A complete nerd, you know, and, you know, was great in school, really smart,
really smart,
particularly in math and the sciences. And I don't ever feel like that he felt comfortable under that white light, the heat and the spotlight of celebrity. Earl did, Tiger didn't. Tiger's ego was tied to the golf course, and his ego, I think, was translated into winning tournaments, particularly majors. And that's where, when you talk about an assassin, that's where the ego came out, is that I'm better than you. You know, I'm better than you. We all know how this is going to end. It's just right. The way it ends. And
right.
I think that's, I mean, he was so intimidating. He had an aura about him. I remember talking to a pro by the name JJ Henry, who I know from Connecticut, and JJ said to me, he was like, you know, it was shape shifting when he would walk into a locker room or onto the course. You know, it was, you know, it was like a different dimension for the, and these are tour pros who are as good as it gets in the business, but even they could sense that there was something different going on. So even though Tiger didn't have, I think, a pronounced ego, forward looking, it certainly showed up in how he carried himself.
Talk to me a little bit about how he changed the face of golf, not just as a player, but the culture of golf.
Well, he was you talk about shape-shifting. I think it was, he had a seismic shift on golf, both culturally, racially, financially, socially. You know, you can just look at when Tiger came into professional golf, to start with financially, I think my memory serves correctly, the total purse on the PGA Tour was around $67 million for all the events. Today, it's nearly $400 million.
Wow.
So the average tournament for the first place winner was about $1.2 million. Now, in many of the tournaments, including the majors and the WGC events, it's $9 or $10 million. There are 400 touring pros who are multimillionaires in large measure because of the impact Tiger Woods had financially on the PGA Tour. And then you talk about racially, okay, did he change through his iconic performances, the face of golf, in terms of participation, not to the degree that Earl expected and hoped it would, but in terms of the number of people and eyeballs he brought to the game, who either showed up on golf courses or watched tournament golf on television, again, an enormous shift and record-setting viewership time and time again, every time Tiger played in the tournament, in a tournament. And culturally, certainly, his iconic status raised the image of golf and the brand of golf far beyond, I think, anything it had happened to the sport short of what Arnold Palmer did to it. So, you know, it's interesting because when you look at what Earl was saying about how Tiger was going to change the game, in a lot of respects, he lived up to Earl's predictions.
Mm-hmm.
He did change the game in ways that no other athlete has ever done. Was he Gandhi or Buddha or Nelson Mandela? No. But, you know, he's about as close to a transformational athlete as you're ever going to find.
So he's playing this very white sport, this genteel sport. Do you have any sense of, even at the height of his career, the kind of racism that he's been subjected to?
Well, you don't even have to go, Kate, to the height of his career. I mean, when he played in his first, I'm sure he heard the N-word on golf courses as a junior, without question, because he was, I don't think there was another African-American. There may have been one other African-American golfer playing at the time. And I would not be surprised to have to have heard or someone to tell me that some of the mumbles and grumbles from those that lost to Tiger, certainly from the parents, would have used the N-word. There's no question there were racial threats when he broke in his first time he ever played in a professional event as an amateur at Riviera Country Club in Los Angeles. I believe it was the Northern Trust. There were death threats that were received by the club regarding Tiger's, the decision to allow Tiger to play in that tournament. Certainly leading up to the Masters, you know, in the first times he played there, there were things said both publicly and privately that were racially motivated and discriminatory. So Tiger never made a big deal out of it. He would make references to it. He never wanted to be the standard bearer of race in the sport. As you well know, he didn't even consider himself Black. He considered himself Kablan Asian, which is a compendium of you know, Asian and Caucasian and Black and other India and Native American. You know, he was a kind of a little a motley mix of a lot of different backgrounds, and I think that that hurt Earl, because Earl thought Tiger was going to be the standard bearer of race, and certainly Nike wanted him to be, because
right,
the Hello World commercial was all of that and more.
So let's talk a little bit about the women in his life. You had extraordinary access to several of them. Unfortunately, not Elin, but his wife, ex-wife. But Dina, I could not believe the access you got, particularly the fact that she had kept a breakup letter. Can you walk me through the relationships, the ones that were most important in his life?
Well, certainly you have to start with Dina. He was, you know, his first true love, and we all remember our first true loves and what that feels like. And you know, she was, if not the most popular girl in high school, certainly one of the most popular. Tiger was, as I said, he was kind of a nerd, and that was attractive to Dina, because, I mean, she had no idea that he played on the golf team. And then when she finally saw him in a tournament, she was like, who is this guy? He basically, you know, walked out of the phone booth and turned into Superman. So that relationship was everything you would expect a high school romance to be, a first true love to be, but it was an inconvenience and it was a threat to Earl and Tita and their grand plan for Tiger. So as you mentioned, you know, there was a moment that it's almost hard to believe where I'm sure under Earl and Tita's pressure, Tiger wrote basically kind of a Dear John letter or a Dear Dina letter that told her in no uncertain terms that they were finished. She was with Tiger at that time in a hotel room, and she got a call from the front desk to say, there's something downstairs for you. And she went downstairs to find that her luggage had been placed right by the front desk, and that letter was there from Tiger. So the fact that Dina saved all that was extraordinary. Those home videos that you see of Tiger dancing and on his back playing the air sax, the first time I saw those, I called Matt Hamachek and I was like, oh my God,
right?
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a Tiger Woods I've never seen before.
Never.
It's interesting. Never. So for us, it was a process. And I originally reached out to Dina, and she was reluctant. She was in Southern California. She lives in Southern California with her husband and children. She wasn't sure whether she wanted to jump back into that world again. And I asked Jeff Benedict, my partner, to reach out. And he was able to begin a conversation with Dina that eventually she consented to be interviewed by Jeff to speak deeply and openly and honestly about her relationship with Tiger. And so when the directors came to us and said, you know, who do you think will sit in the chair? One of our first names was, you know, was Dina Gravel, now Dina Parr. But that had to be, that relationship had to be reconstructed from the documentary end, through Jenna Millman and through Matt Hamachek, who waited outside Dina's house one day in Southern California until she got home, knocked on the door. He allowed them in. They began a conversation, which eventually led to her doing an interview. So that's certainly one of the most important women in his life.
And by the way, I'm glad that she did talk, because I do think she was able to humanize him in a way, and then also to give the perspective of parents that are that invested into his future and becoming paranoid that he wanted to go to school at UNLV to be close to her, the idea of her becoming pregnant. I think that really helps put in perspective the parents of some athletes that are playing at a certain level.
Well, stop at nothing. I mean, literally, if that to me is when a parent, two parents step in and just say, it's over, you know, no ifs, ands, or buts, and basically cleaving somebody out of your life that you had fallen in love with. There were people that told us, and I don't have no reason to doubt it, that Tiger really wanted to go to UNLV, and they had a very good golf team under Coach Dwayne Knight. He was still there, but that just wasn't in the cards. He was going to become, you know, a Cardinal, literally, at Stanford, because that was the road that Tita and Earl had mapped out for Tiger. So you have Dina, and then, you know, there's a lot of women that move along the conveyor belt in Tiger's life.
Right.
Until you get to Rachel Yucatel. And I have a certain opinion about their relationship that I could run contrary to some of the female members of your audience, but
no,
when you listen to Rachel,
I don't know. You might be surprised when she says on screen, he told me, you know, that I was the only one he loved. I wondered if she believed that, because to your point, he had a sexual addiction, and the sexual addiction was about pain relief. And I think he was so in pain, he would have said anything at that point. So I often wonder if does she realize that he didn't really mean it? I don't think he meant it.
Well, that's a really interesting way to look at it, because I saw it the other way. No question that Tiger was addicted to sex. And I say that as the person who did all the reporting and all the writing on sex addiction for the book. And just to take a little bit of a side road, I've been married for 41 years. And at the time I was doing all this reporting, I was seeing this particular sex addiction expert in New York for some time. I think I saw him, Bart Mandel, I think I saw him five or six times, because I was immersed in that world trying to understand it. But my wife would say, so what are you doing? I said, oh, I'm going to see Bart in New York. You know, I've got a 2-hour meeting, an interview with him today. And she goes, meeting? Is that what, meeting? You're meeting him for what? You're meeting, why do you need to spend 2 hours?
Well, no, I mean, can you blame her? Yeah.
No, I can't blame her. It was hysterical. And then Monica Meyer, who was, you know, one of the people that is now out at the Meadows, where that is really the premier sex addiction clinic in the country based on the Pine Grove principles. And she was, you know, part of that group. I met her in Arizona, and my wife is about, you know, had it with me at that point in time, but you're absolutely right to understand that that sex addiction is pain relief. It's like gambling. It's like drugs. It's like alcohol. And that to me was really eye opening in terms of understanding it. But when you get to Rachel, you're going to see, and you've seen part two, there's a moment where she talks about when Tiger would call her and say, I need to plug into you, and what that meant to her and what that meant to them. I don't know. You've got to be pretty far down the path of deception and double lives or triple lives when you text somebody, "You're the only one I've ever loved." Because if you want to throw a 30-ton megaton bomb into your marriage, that's probably the language you want to use.
Well, sure. Just because he said it, though, I think that he loved the way she made him feel. I don't think he loved her.
Well, that's a really interesting perspective. And I could be a little naive in that, and hearing it from the female perspective. I have a tendency now, as you're talking through this and taking a little deeper look into the microscope, to see how you could absolutely feel that way, because he was playing all these different women.
He was
at the same time.
Right.
Rachel was not the only one. There were at least two or three other women that he was juggling at the same time he was married to Elin. So I can see, and each of them in their own way provided what Tiger was looking for. Most of it was just sex.
Right.
You just meet, greet, and move on. I felt like Rachel had, there was a different relationship, certainly from her perspective, no question. She was in love with Tiger.
Oh, no doubt.
All those women were in love with Tiger. Why wouldn't you be in love with Tiger? You know, the Perkins cocktail or the Perkins waitress was
wild.
In love with Tiger.
That is wild.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you want to go down a, you know, not so garden path, you know, the Mindy Lawton story is just, you know, what that did, why he did it, how they had to cover it up. When you're talking about waiting for something to blow up in your life, that's a pretty good place to start.
Well, that showed to me that he was ready for his life to, he was ready for someone to figure it all out.
Oh,
because
yeah.
When you're being that brazen to want to sleep with the woman that's waiting on you and your family, and having sex in your own home, you're ready for someone to find out what's really happening.
Yes. And I think as we were writing the book, we always saw it as a journey, and the acceleration of Tiger headed off a cliff. One of the things that I think was the smartest thing we did was we made this timeline, a very detailed timeline. I think it was 70,000 words. It was 120 pages of Tiger's life, Earl's life, Tita's life. And at a certain point in time, you can see the speedometer is just moving right all the time. He is going off a cliff, and you're not sure when he's going to go, but he's going, because he's doing exactly what you said he was doing, which he's living one life, he's living six lives.
Right.
And you just can't sustain that over time. And, you know, the culmination was what happened Thanksgiving 2009, but it could have easily happened a month before or a month after or 2 months after. It was going to happen sooner or later.
It's so interesting how private his ex-wife Elin is as well. The fact that both of them, typically we see these athletes and there's at least one member of the union that enjoys the celebrity that comes with it. And we're talking about two people that were very comfortable never speaking to the press. In fact, I think I've heard her voice maybe one time.
Yeah, she was perfect for Tiger in so many ways. Not only how beautiful she was and how smart Elin is and how poised and how prepared in many ways, just emotionally was for the roller coaster that they were on. But, you know, you said we didn't talk to Elin. I think there's a point in our reporting that I should make that I find interesting. We certainly reached out to Elin through intermediaries and things. But what we were able to do, and Jeff was really responsible for this, we established a relationship with her attorney who was responsible for negotiating the divorce. And essentially, it was the breakup of a, call it what you want, maybe a $500 billion company. So it really wasn't the typical divorce. But we were able to communicate with her attorney on where we were headed in our storytelling, and to fact check some things that we had found out And he was very helpful in keeping us on track. And there was one time when Jeff said to him, do you think we could speak to Elon about this? And there was this little pause, and he said, you are speaking to Elon about this.
Oh my gosh.
So in essence,
telling.
And then Sandra, who's the People magazine writer who wrote the one and only big story, the cover story for People, she's in the doc in part two. And she tells some just heart crushing stories about what Elon was going through during that period of time. And, you know, I don't know about you, Kate, but you've seen part two, I believe. And the media onslaught after the fall, where Tiger's on the destruction of Tiger's life and his marriage becomes a form of entertainment for late night talk show hosts and, The View and comics, and you're on the cover of the New York Post for 21 straight days, a record longer than 9/11. I think what the two Matts did was mesmerizing.
I agree.
In this autopsy of, and that's, let's not forget, that's before Twitter and really what we're experiencing now in social media. But I don't think there's ever been an athlete whose fall from grace has been so joyously celebrated by the tabloid media and people who used it for their own benefit and for the entertainment of others. And that to me is a very cautionary tale as part of the doc.
Right. And you have that one expert that says, I believe in part two, he says, be careful about the narrative that you're crafting. And so I think as a viewer, you're going to think, we're all sort of complicit in this story and the downfall part. He's complicit because he, like, for example, that press conference where he walks out and apologizes and then he walks over to his mother. I mean, maybe this is me as a former media consultant for law firms. I would have never advised him to have done that. He should have made a statement immediately and said, this is a private matter between myself and my wife, and I will not speak any more about it, and set a boundary. And the fact that he had counsel that encouraged him to do that, I think, made it all the worse. It's like hanging a light
on it. I totally agree with you.
Yeah, that was terrible.
There was a lot of people that I think there was conflict in that camp that I know there was as to whether he should come forward or not. And there was pressure from one side that he had to do something because, let's not forget, he was a $100 million a year athlete with corporations that had invested millions and millions of dollars into his image. So whether there was pressure from that end, eventually all but a very, very few jumped ship from Tiger. How much Nike's influence was involved in him coming forward, I'm not 100% sure, but I agree with you. If that had been, and I know Michael Jordan has come out and said it publicly, if that had happened to him, he would have said exactly what you said. This is a private matter. I'm not going to say another word about it and leave it at that. That press conference was, seen around the world, and it was as stilted and as ill-advised as you could possibly hope for, or not hope for, as the case may be.
And then to have him walk over to his mother, very emasculating, and then his wife's not there. Not that I would have wanted her there. Absolutely, she should not have been there, but just very bizarre. And then the other press conference that's so illuminating in the second part is the press conference that Billy Payne has. And then the brilliant commentary from Bryant Gumbel. I just think that ultimately this event and those few years afterwards is this bizarre vortex where you're looking at the price of genius, you're looking at the role of media, you're looking at racism in sports and in golf. And there's just so much to unpack. I mean, no wonder it took you 3 years. I mean, there's so much there.
Yeah.
One of the things I wanted to ask you too was his relationship with Lindsey Vonn. It seemed to me that there were a lot of blind items in that time period that had suggested that it was a publicity move to date each other Do you have reason to believe that that could be true?
No, I don't. I think that they were in a lot of ways kind of two peas in a pod. Lindsay's background with her father and her upbringing, very similar to Tiger's in the pressure that she endured and how she felt kind of like a fish out of water in terms of her body image and her competitive nature. And I thought that they were, I thought they were really good for each other during the period of time that they were together. I mean, Tiger flying to Europe when Lindsay had that horrific crash, doing something that wasn't about himself.
Right. That's
true. It was for somebody else.
Yeah.
Which is extraordinary when you think of Tiger, because mostly it's about Tiger.
Mm-hmm.
I know just from the reporting that we did that Lindsay was very attracted to the family, to the two kids, was very comfortable in that world. But again, they were living very separate lives, and it's hard at that level of celebrity to see how, they could stay together. So, you almost forget that Lindsay Vonn was a part of this thing,
you know,
in a way.
You're right.
And that's just weird because she was a big part of Tiger's life for several years. But in the scheme of things, it's so funny. It's like Mark Steinberg, his agent, when he was criticizing the doc, which he wants to do just because he's got nothing else to do, said it was an incomplete, look at his life, a portrait of his life. Well, of course it is.
Right.
It's 3 hours and 15 minutes long. It's not The Last Dance. It's not 10 hours. It's not 30 hours.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Tiger Woods, you could do a 30-hour documentary on Tiger Woods if
right.
you wanted to.
Okay.
And it would probably hold people's attention for most of those 30 minutes. But the decisions that the two Matts made, and what you're saying, I think is really astute in terms of what you're seeing and what they were trying to accomplish, to the tone and the texture and the depth and the decisions that were made in that doc as to where to land and how long to land and what you were wanted to say and the words that come out of people's mouths. There's not a lot of wasted ums and ahs or people that are pontificating that don't make a cogent point
mm-hmm.
that moves the doc forward. And that's from the arts of the interviews, but it's also from the director's decisions and the editor's decisions to say, okay, right here, right now, this is what we feel was happening in Tiger's life. And this is a message that we feel is fair and balanced and appropriate to send.
I also think that Mark said that because he's laying the foundation for him to do his own documentary, his own project, so he can control the narrative.
No question.
Yeah.
I mean, if you had to use three words that would describe the public relations side of Tiger Woods, it's control the narrative.
Yeah.
And that's all they really care about. If Tiger doesn't have control of the project, he's not going to do the project. And I know he's in the midst of working on a book right now. I believe I know who the author is and the co-author is, and he's a phenomenal collaborator. So I'll be interested to see what happens when that book comes out. And I'm sure somebody, whether it's Discovery, who he's got a multi-million dollar deal with, or one of the streaming services, or ESPN, does what they are want to do these days, is to go really big into something. But I just don't know. I read everything Tiger wrote as far as his books, including the one that celebrated his 20th anniversary of his win at the Masters with Lauren Rubenstein. And it was it had moments of real insight. And it really helped Jeff and I understand him in certain places. But I just can't believe there are places in Tiger's life that he's willing to go. And he shouldn't have to go there. Not everybody has to know everything about everybody's life.
Of course, of course. So a couple quick questions. His relationship
yes.
with Elin today, and also what do the younger golfers like Justin and et cetera, what do they think of him, their relationship with him?
Well, I think his relationship, I would have said, I don't know about Evelyn because, you know, you hear certain stories, but the fact that she showed up at the PNC where the father-son tournament was, and she walked with Erica, Tiger's girlfriend, now longtime girlfriend, together, tells you that, you know, she has found some.
Well, he calls her his best friend.
Yeah. I mean, we could spend 3 hours trying to figure out what was going on there.
Right.
I mean, the best friend is, do you do something like that to your best friend?
No,
I don't know. I think you have to look at that and say, okay. I think a much more interesting or certainly more public aspect to look at is what you said. I think that Tiger's relationships with the Ricky Fowlers, the Justin Thomases, the Xander Schauffeles, the young guns on the tour, has been one of the best things that's ever happened to him. He is the elder statesman now. He was there. Their reason for getting into the game of golf. That there's no question that they all looked up to him and the way he played the game, and the fact that he can compete with them and play with them down in Florida and joke around and talk shit and do all the stuff that he loves to do. That's great for him because, there's no telling whether he's going to win another golf tournament or another major. And in my mind, he doesn't have to do another thing. I think the greatest comeback of his career was walking out of that hole in the ground that he dug for himself that led to that Memorial Day weekend, and walking back into the light and being a better father and a better husband and a better person, a more human being than he's ever been. So what we witnessed and what you will witness in part two at the Masters in 19, if that's not a storybook ending, I don't know what is. And so, I think the guy's already lived three lifetimes. I think it's, it'd be nice if we just let him, alone for a while and let him live at least a portion of the rest of his life the way he wants to live it.
This has been spectacular. I can't thank you enough. You are best of the best. This is a book that is like a Bible that people need to have on their bookshelves. Really can't tell you what a great job enough. So thank you for your time, and tell everybody where they can read your book and how they can follow you.
Well, you can read it. It's on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or independent bookstores. God bless them. They've been, and even now I think Target just made a huge order for us based on the doc, and it's Barnes & Noble made a huge order for the paperback. So it's available out there. And then, if you want to follow me, it's at Armin Katayan at Twitter. That's the only place you'll really find me, is because I'm not a social media hound. So I'm not on Facebook. I'm not on Instagram. I'm not on Twitch. I'm not on anything. So other than Twitter, and I will engage occasionally with people there. But, I'm just thank you, Kate. It was really, really enjoyable to speak with you. And I hope sometime we can do it again.
The amazing Kate Casey.
I want to thank my great guest, Armin, and remind you guys to go to iTunes. Make sure you subscribe to the show. You can join the Facebook group, Reality Life with Kate Casey, to talk about this episode and others. Share what you're watching, what you're listening to as well. You can find me on Twitter at Kate Casey. I'd love to hear what you think about the episode. You can find me on Instagram at Kate Casey CA. I'm on Clubhouse at Kate Casey. And my Patreon is patreon.com/KateCasey, where you can find bonus episodes. So even more of Reality Life with Kate Casey episodes. I'm wishing you all a great week, and I can't wait to circle back with you on Friday.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.